Do you have a sense that things are speeding up?
I think they're latent. I think there's a huge potential of a destiny kind of, you could, a politician might call it an issue, I would say it's more than that, but it's like a great bait sitting there. Somebody like Gorbachev would understand it and take it. We don't have any politicians here. I met with the chair of the board of a huge Trans-America, having given him the pitch, he looked at it, looked at the film and other things and said, you know, this is a very important idea, but don't, you know, it's pearls to swine to throw the thing at either side of Washington right now. We've got to find somebody who has some problems of being a leader the public believes in, and sell it, be ready to sell it to them. So we're working the states for governors. And we've gotten the governor of New Jersey fired up on the idea, and some others. All that, as you know, also then putting in a third or half your time in fundraising and all the rest of things that go with being the free voice in the nonprofit world.
How much of your time do you suppose you spend actually doing what your purpose is to do?
Well, I don't differentiate. I find that often fundraising is the best form of education. If you get a school child to commit a quarter to a concept, or an adult to commit a dollar to a concept, reforesting the landscape, or supporting a political figure who says, yes, I'll lead and clean up the environment, that may be the most important form of education. So I equate that to much of what I would do.
That's an interesting example, because you're not talking about big bucks here. You're talking about
right.
Education.
But the same thing is true of someone who is a billionaire, and you happily look them in the eye and say, you know, I would like you to give me $1 million this year and for the next 5 years. In one sense, they're looking, as the school child is looking, for some sense of hope and sanity and all the opportunities they have, pace of change.
So it sounds like you see people pretty much as the same, as equals.
I do. I think ultimately, in order to solve the greatest problem that we have today, and that is to create hope. We, it seems to me, in this age of technology and dreams, have a serious society-wide problem. I say society-wide in all the industrialized nations. For all the technology and the comforts we thought we were delivering, you know, the salvation of all things, President Eisenhower saying, oh, well, we'll be able to throw away our meters to measure electricity because nuclear energy is going to save us all. You know, that maybe is the most classic example. Well, it didn't, and it's become a nightmare because we can't get rid of the waste. And still a complex, uncertain, confusing theme instead of solving anything. So we have a dilemma, and that is the children of this generation and of the recent generation, industrialized nations, really are very doubtful about the future. All of us know someone, tragically often our own children, who have very little hope for the future. And a society cannot survive that cannot deliver hope for its children. That is why I think that we have this transition point that we now, vast majority of us are in the industrialized nations, are environmentalists, or would be seen as such. Sweden, Germany, Australia, the U.S. And thus the industrial sector is shifting and coming our way. It's moving very quickly. And part of that is this need for hope. I think many leaders have children and grandchildren. They get that message, and more they see the practical reasons for doing it from a cost basis. They see the problems are real as far as global pollution, death of the seas, global warming. They've moved ahead of governments many times. That's it. And become far cleaner and far more demanding in their environmental quality management.
I often hear a great tension between activists and corporations, but corporations are fictitious persons. How do you see corporations?
It's an approach I haven't considered before. I would say I view them as entities run by human beings who have policies, and complex societies need that management context, whether it's a government theme, the church, the university, your town, you need the mail delivered and the schools painted and teachers hired, not need them. It takes some sort of management structure. And then basically corporations evolve into that. They compete and they find a niche and they do something or deliver something. And they're made up of human beings ultimately. And those human beings have values and they can be talked to. And I think that we're getting a more enlightened sector all the time. We still have the extreme, I would call them the old guard, who refuse to believe anything other than simplistic profits and losses.
Is there a need for more accountability of corporations in international business?
I think there is, and I think it's happening. I use the example of these green, what I describe as green plan nations, where industries have stepped forward and said the problem is real, we know how to manage, government, let's sit down and decide what the steps are going to be, and let's proceed with this new skill we have, bringing management to bear on the problem of environmental quality. And that leads to information management. The Dutch, the best example in the world today, I think, of environmental quality recovery, were the one place that was able to say, okay, when the industry said, you tell us what you want to have done, they were able to hit their computers and say, here's where 95% of the pollution comes from. They listed each industry, utilities, chemicals, transportation. And then the industries were able to say, okay, we know what it will take to improve. And they were given a time span, which was important to them, stability within time. And they were given the opportunity to be responsible, where before it was as though, as we often do, our environmental quality management is an inch wide and a mile deep on an issue, while leaving the broader context of environmental quality, we tend to focus on little things. They said, in essence, okay, much like having a driver's license, we're not going to have a traffic cop at every intersection anymore. You're expected not to run red lights, and you're expected to get your car depolluted or whatever. And that's the way the Dutch businesses have been allowed to proceed. And it's working very well. They have goals now, and they're brutally honest in the press. And that is starting to spread out into the world. As much as anything, one of the positive sides of world trade.
But you, in that case, there's a sovereign authority that commands the attention of the corporations. How does that work when you begin to talk about international trade?
The issue is relationships and process. If there's any massive change that we're involved in now with this ability to manage information and ideas that we can conclude in seconds that it would 15 or 20 years ago take us years of research to even begin to get close to the second school child can ask what a reflective database there is, what the best information is. And with this kind of change, we get into process. All of a sudden, we're no longer forced to always reduce our thought into simpler and simpler and simpler terms, when reality is complex and more complex and more complex. We've been going this way with information, because that's a scientific approach. And really, we're dealing with complexity and chaos, and the evolution of those ideas are becoming very practical and manageable. So we have a simple pollution problem solved by one nation. An example of how the local regulations can affect the global condition happened with the San Francisco-based clothing company, a huge one. And they put their plans together to open a whole new market in Germany. They spent millions of dollars. They're all ready to go. And suddenly somebody said, uh-oh, we've just got news from the German government that the dyes that we use in our clothes, which are legal in the U.S., are not legal to be used in Germany. And so this company, somebody made the mistake of not checking the levels of detail. The result was, the chair of the board said, we became totally environmental. Our conclusion was, as a corporation, we couldn't fiddle around wondering if we were complying with somebody's regulations. Evermore will be above everyone's regulations.
Ah, so one jurisdiction can set the standard.
Yeah, as a way, an example of process and complexity coming out in the practical result. And that really is happening internationally.
That's interesting, because that points the way towards how we can go towards a global order or civilization and still retain sovereign units.
It's an interesting reality, and suggests that in the complexity, i.e. of global marketing, I was questioning that because you know, we were just pushing consumption that the world can't sustain without thinking about it. And but here is a positive side already. So things are always somewhat unpredictable.
It's rather like how California set the standard for emissions in the United States.
Right.
Are we better informed than we were 20 years ago, or are we just more confused?
We're definitely better informed. I would say we, again, the industrialized nations. And if one looks at the wondrous flow of information, just there are two or three environmental newsletters. I look at the one on the internet every day. And that thing, the screens whirl by, and there's half a dozen decisions in Congress and three or four decisions by corporations that are unique. Some fines where people said they absolutely wouldn't or didn't. Various things happen. And the communication process is so terrific. I view a lot of the dramatic change that we've had, the collapse of the Soviet Union, was based on information change, I think. Suddenly it was no longer possible for a handful of leaders to control information, whether they were Soviet or ours or anything. Once we have a global communications network, the old way of directing, managing, autocratically or otherwise, dissolved, that happened.
What role do you think that Mikhail Gorbachev has played in the shape of the world that we're now in?
I view him, I had dinner with him since he's been here, with Babe Brower, and I view those two as the global environmental leaders today. Both people are capable of seeing the dimensions of the future. Most environmentalists, all of us have been so, we've been trained by scientists to think in cubes and squares and reduce all thought to smaller units. These two understand the challenge at hand, the threat is very real, they have the courage to stand up and say so and say we must solve it. And it is great fun to be there and talk to them and see them, and I considered it an honor. And as someone said, the two greatest political figures in the last several centuries, this guy said Napoleon and Gorbachev. There was some discussion about it. So I feel we're very lucky to have an association with him here.
That must have been quite a dinner, you and David Brower and Mikhail Gorbachev.
And others, but I was at the same table.
A lot of talking, I imagine.
Yeah.
Mikhail Gorbachev writes about a spirit of cooperation. And this is in a world that has evolved in nations that have always been in conflicts with each other. And now we have corporations who are in competition with each other. Realistically, how do we evolve ourselves to where we're practicing this spirit of cooperation?
If the problem is great enough, humanity has always proven it has the ability to cooperate. In my lifetime, I was a small child when World War II occurred. And the whole nation, the only time in my life experience, was pulling together in the same rope. If you saw a nail in the road, you picked it up, as did a bank president if he saw a nail in the road or she, put it in the war trash pile in the town square. Gorbachev speaks of a similar impact, far more dramatic than mine. But the idea of pulling together, when you visit Russia and see what people did in St. Petersburg against the Nazi army, that is tragic beyond belief and courageous beyond imagination. But humanity has this ability, and now we are faced with a threat as great as that we've confronted in war. Except this is an opportunity to survive, to work together, to deliver a livable future by understanding the environmental threat is real. And we have the tools now to solve it, and it really is a matter of cooperation to achieve that.
What role is Gorbachev playing in that?
I don't know. At dinner, I appealed to him that the Dutch Green Plan approach, the New Zealand, Singapore examples, were the doorway to the future. I reflected that the two great gifts of Dutch culture would have been the Dutch masters 500 years ago, and this concept of environmental quality recovery today, and it should be seen in that context, and he should see it and take it up and make it his cause. And he shook my hand and smiled and said he agreed with me. I don't see what happens.
That's
but I think he needs a focus because he is the global leader in this stuff. But if he doesn't have a focus that people can understand and get involved with, then much of his leadership is wasted. And I fear that right now.
What an interesting contradiction that a man who entered the world stage as the president of the Soviet Union should become the leading figure in the environmental movement. How did that happen?
When he spoke, he always cared about it. He spoke to the UN the last time. I think he mentioned environmental quality 12 times while he was still president. We haven't had a president speak of the environment since Teddy Roosevelt in that context. And that's really what we have in the form of a leader. These nations that are out in front demonstrating a pathway to the future have had the good fortune of having leaders like that. The Queen of the Netherlands, Queen Beatrix, now called the Green Queen because she gave a dramatic speech, the only speech he's allowed to give a year on the environment, 1988. The minister, Prime Minister of New Zealand, Palmer, said he went to the universe. I asked him why he had had such a passion. That was the one thing he wanted to accomplish in politics. He said, well, several answers, but one, I went to the University of Chicago Law School. He said, I couldn't go for walks at night because the neighborhoods were dangerous, and I could see the pollution belching out of the pipes on the lake shoreline from the steel mills. And he decided, shivering one night in the cold, very lonely as a young student, that if he ever had a chance to make sure New Zealand was never like South Chicago, that would be his objective. And that's what he did.
Why isn't there passion like that in our leadership in the United States?
I think we're stuck with a two-party system. We're stuck with a tragic amount of money that needs to be raised to get elected. No political figure can lead. They have to compromise endlessly to get the millions of dollars, whatever it is, $35 million to run for presidency. And it's burnt the excitement of politics. The American public understands that, I think.
You mentioned Roosevelt. That brings to mind to me Normandy, the way in which the Allies established a beachhead in order to beat Hitler. Mm-hmm. But in the efforts to save the planet, we're still just sort of scratching at the edges.
Correct.
When are we going to meet this threat as seriously as we met one dictator 50 years ago?
One fears that it will take a catastrophe, an oil spill of great dimensions, another Chernobyl. That certainly will jolt us. We should be so concerned now over the problems of Africa that would move us as a world to respond. We are a step closer, constantly stepping closer to that point. And I find the excitement, again, of the Netherlands, where everyone in the country, school children, executives of corporations, everyone understands now. They're working on a shared principle to deliver a livable future. And that hope that comes out of that is very critical, and it's exciting and positive. It's a thing that we don't have, and I think in part it has to come from some political leader or leaders. It's probably going to happen, it would appear, from governors first. That's at least where we're working, particularly in the States, pushing the idea that we push the green plan theme for that reason. But it also is happening in corporations. Hewlett-Packard, 3M, Hewlett-Packard has an annual environmental statement, and they flat out say we will manage environmental quality at above government levels wherever we are in the world. That's dramatic stuff. 3M has got a 100-year plan to take non-renewables out of the stuff they're manufacturing so that they'll always put in things that can be created by sunlight organically, wood, fibers of one sort or another. And those are dramatic breakthroughs from where we were 20 years ago.